old was she, and what had happened to her? It was too late now. She could hardly get out her phone and start researching in front of Mr. Trezick. But the idea of having some basic facts to arm herself with before she faced her supposed uncles was enticing. She could not afford to slip up again. Could she creep away when they got to the house? Perhaps if she asked to change into dry clothes? She kept silent for the rest of the journey, as did Mr. Trezick, though he shot the odd glance at Hal as the Volvo ate up the long country miles. It was only as the car began to slow down that Hal sat up, and Mr. Trezick raised his voice above the noise of the wipers. "Here we are," he indicated left, the flashing light turning the raindrops golden. "Trepassen House. Ah, the gates are open, very good. I must say, I didn't relish the idea of struggling with the latch in this weather." They turned carefully through the giant wrought-iron gates and began to wend their way up a long gravel drive. Far up ahead was a long, low building, and with a jolt, as they came round the corner, Hal realised that she recognised it. An image flashed into her head. Tall windows, a sweep of grass falling away. And there it was, appearing before her eyes like a conjuring trick. Hal felt her mouth drop open, and for a moment it seemed inexplicable, and then, with a little rush of chagrin, she realised. Of course, it was the postcard she had found online. "We had a very good tea at Trepassen House." It had been taken from just slightly further along the lawn, and the jolt of recognition she had experienced was nothing but the perspective slotting into place. But even as she recognised the image, she was noticing the changes. The ivy and Virginia creeper that had been decorous little trails in that original postcard, but now ran riot over the front of the house, seeming to strangle the bay windows and the columns that supported the porch. The paintwork was no longer the pristine white of the postcard, but cracked and flaking, and the lawns were overgrown, weeds growing between the flags of the terrace. Hal felt her hopes begin to ebb away a little, along with the righteous certainty she had felt on the train. Where were the ponies, the signs of the foreign holidays, the expensive suits? If there was money here, it had not been spent for a long, long time. They drove past a copse of yew trees, the rain momentarily stopping as they passed beneath the thick canopy of the branches. And as they did, a flurry of black and white swooped without warning from the tree above, and Mr. Trezick swerved and ground a tire on one of the granite boulders marking the edge of the drive. "Damnation!" he sounded flustered as he righted their course and drove more slowly up the final few yards to the house, the rain resuming as they left the shelter of the copse. "What was it?" Hal asked, looking back over her shoulder. "A gull?"
"No, a magpie. The house is plagued with them, absolutely plagued. They can be surprisingly aggressive."
He drove through a vaulted arch and slowed to a halt in a gravelled carriage yard to the right of the main frontage. There he turned off the engine and wiped his palms shakily on his trousers.
"It's supposed to be the origin of the name, you know. Piassen is the Cornish word for magpie, and tre means farm or farmstead. So they say Trepassen is a corruption of tre piassen, magpie farm. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea, but it certainly lives up to the name. Another theory holds that it's to do with the Cornish word for the past, Passien. Myself, I don't know. I'm no Cornish scholar, I'm afraid."
He smoothed his hair and unclipped his seatbelt, looking, for the first time since Hal had seen him, more than a little rattled.
I am not very fond of birds. It's something of a phobia. Much as I would love to overcome it, I have not been able to. And the magpie's here.
He gave a little involuntary shudder.
Well, as I said, they are really rather numerous, and not at all shy. At least,
he reached for his umbrella and gave a small, rather mirthless smile,
at least in this house one has no danger of sorrow.
Sorrow? Hal said, startled.
Why, yes, don't you know the rhyme? One for sorrow, two for joy, and so on. Although joy seems equally unlikely, I've never seen anything less than half a dozen magpies congregated here.
Yes, Hal said slowly. Yes, I know the rhyme. Her hand went to her shoulder, and she touched the skin there beneath the thin coat, remembering, and then let her hand drop. At least, I know the first four lines. Does it go as far as six?
Oh, yes,
Mr. Trezick said, and then frowned.
Let me see. One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy. What's the next bit? Five for silver, six, I think, is gold. Yes, that's right, six for gold.
Six for gold, Hal thought. She bit her lip. If she was superstitious, she might call that an omen. But she was not. Years of working the cards had not made her more of a believer, if anything, quite the opposite. There were many readers out there who did believe she had met them, but Hal knew, for she had seen it up close and personal, that signs and symbols were created by people looking for patterns and answers. In and of themselves, they meant nothing. Now Mr. Trezick had pointed them out, she could see the magpies, sheltering in the yew tree copse. Two were on the ground, pecking at the berries, four up in the branches, and the last, the one that had dive-bombed the car, was sitting on the porch roof in the rain, looking balefully down at them. What about seven? She said lightly. More gold?
No,
Mr. Trezick said with a laugh.
Alas, not.
He climbed out of the car and hurried round with the umbrella unfurled. He spoke above the sound of the rain drumming on the fabric.
Seven is the last line of the rhyme. Seven magpies are for a secret never to be told.
Perhaps it was the rain or the wind that blew up the valley. But Hal could not help shivering as she took her case out of the car boot and followed Mr. Trezick under cover of his umbrella into the porch of Trepassen House. 4th of December, 1994. I was sick again this morning, skittering down the steep stairs and down the long passageway to the toilet in my nightgown, kneeling on the cold tiled floor to heave up the last remains of yesterday's dinner. Afterwards, I brushed my teeth, huffing on my hands to make sure my breath didn't have any telltale sourness. But when I opened the door to the corridor, Maud was standing outside, her arms crossed over the ratty old Smith's T-shirt that she wears instead of proper pyjamas. She said nothing, but there was something in her expression that I didn't like. It was a look of mingled concern and something else, I'm not sure what. I think it might have been pity. The thought made me angry. She was leaning against the wall, blocking my way, and she didn't move as I came out and shut the bathroom door behind me. Sorry, I shook my hair back from my face, trying to look unconcerned. Were you waiting long? Yes, she said flatly. Long enough. Are you all right? Of course, I said, pushing past her, forcing her to step backwards against the wall. Why wouldn't I be? I called over my shoulder. She shrugged, but I know what she meant. I know exactly what she meant. I thought about the expression on her face, the way her flat black eyes followed me as I walked back to my attic. And as I sit here in bed writing this on my knees, watching the magpies swooping low over the snowy garden, I am wondering, how far can I trust her? Chapter 11. Mr. Trezick led the way through a side entrance into a vaulted vestibule tiled with red terracotta squares. Hal followed him in, shaking her head as the hiss of the rain was replaced with the hollow drip of water pattering from her coat and Mr. Trezick's umbrella.
"Mrs. Warren,"
he called, his voice echoing along the long corridor.
"Oh, Mrs. Warren, it's Mr. Trezick."
There was a silence, and then Hal heard, as though from a great distance, the click, 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 click of heels on the tiled floor, each set of steps followed by an unfamiliar chink. She turned her head, and through the glass panes of the door to her left, she saw an old lady dressed all in black, half walking, half hobbling along the corridor.
"Is that Mrs. Warren?"
she whispered to Mr. Trezick, before she could think better of the question.
"But she looks..."
"She must be 80 if she's a day," Mr. Trezick said under his breath. "But she wouldn't hear of retirement while your grandmother was alive."
"Is that you, Bobby?"
Her accent was broad Cornish, and the voice was cracked as a raven's. Mr. Trezick winced, and in spite of her nerves, Hal was a little amused to see a flush of red beneath his grey stubbled cheek. He removed his overcoat and coughed.
"It's Robert Trezick, Mrs. Warren,"
he called down the corridor, but she shook her head.
"Speak up, boy. I can't hear you. All you young people are the same, mumble, mumble."
As she came closer, Hal saw that she was using a cane, and the iron ferrule on the tiles was the chink she had heard. It gave her step an odd, uneven rhythm. Click, click, chink. Click, click, chink. At long last, she reached the door and paused to fumble with her cane before Mr. Trezick sprang to hold it open and she hobbled through.
"So..."
She ignored Mr. Trezick, and her surprisingly dark, bright eyes settled on Hal. There was an expression in them that Hal couldn't read, but it wasn't warmth. Far from it, a kind of speculation, perhaps. There was absolutely no smile in her voice as she said,
"You're the girl. Well, well, well."
"I..."
Hal swallowed. Her throat was dry as dust, and she became suddenly aware of her defensive stance. Her folded arms, her hair hanging down to shield her face. "Think of the client," her mother's voice in her head. "Think of what they want to see when they come to you." She wished she had taken out her large thorn earring, but it was too late for that now. She forced a smile, making her face as open and unthreatening as possible.
"Yes, that's me."
She held out a hand to shake, but the old lady turned away as if she hadn't seen it, and she was forced to let it drop.
"They didn't tell me if you were coming,"
Mrs. Warren shot over her shoulder.
"But I had a room aired in case. You'll be wanting to change your clothes."
It was a command, not a request, and Hal nodded in meek agreement.
"Follow me,"
Mrs. Warren said. Hal caught Mr. Trezick's eye and raised one eyebrow in mute question. He gave a dry little smile and waved his hand towards the stairs, but Mrs. Warren hadn't waited for Hal to acquiesce and was already making her way painfully up the long flight, step by step, her arthritic knuckles clamped to the banisters.
"It'll have to be the attic,"
she said, as Hal hastened up after her, her case bumping each step. There were brass stair rods across each tread, but so much dust had lodged in the crevices around them, it was almost impossible to see them, or the pattern of the carpet beneath.
"Of course,"
Hal said breathlessly as they reached the landing, and Mrs. Warren began another flight, this one carpeted with a more utilitarian stair runner that felt hard and bumpy beneath Hal's feet.
"No problem at all."
"There's no point in complaining," Mrs. Warren said grimly, as if Hal had done so. "No warning I had, so you'll have to put up with it."
"It's fine," Hal said.
She pushed down the prickle of resentment at Mrs. Warren's manner and smiled again, hoping it showed through in her voice.
"Honestly, I wouldn't dream of complaining. I'm very grateful to have a room at all."
They had reached what seemed to be the top landing. There were no more stairs from here, only a tiled passageway with a long row of what seemed to be bedrooms coming off each side. A window must have been open in one of the bedrooms, for there was a cold draught blowing, forceful enough to stir the dust around Hal's ankles as she stood.
"Lavatory is there,"
Mrs. Warren said shortly, nodding at a door at the far end of the tiled corridor.
"The bathroom is a floor below."
The bathroom? Surely there had to be more than one bathroom for this whole house. But Mrs. Warren had opened one of the doors that Hal had taken to be bedrooms, revealing a narrow staircase set into the wall. She pressed a light switch, and a bare bulb at the top flickered and illuminated a narrow flight. This one, bare wood, with no carpet, not even drugget, just a thin strip of lino at the top landing. The old lady started up the steps, her metal-tipped cane thudding against the wood as she climbed. Hal waited at the foot of the stairs, under the pretense of catching her breath. There was something she didn't like about that staircase. Perhaps it was the narrowness of it, or the lack of natural light, for there were no windows, not even a skylight. Or perhaps it was the way that it seemed to be shut away from the rest of the house, the door at the bottom hiding its very existence. But she swallowed, and pushing the door as wide as she could, she hitched up her case and followed Mrs. Warren up the final flight.
"Is this where the servants used to sleep?"
she asked, hearing her voice echo in the confined space.
"No,"
Mrs. Warren said shortly, without turning back. Hal felt snubbed, but when they reached the landing, Mrs. Warren stopped and looked at her, and seemed to relent a little.
"Not any more. They moved the servants' quarters over the kitchen when they rebuilt," she said. "Of course, they're all shut up now. There's only me left, and I sleep downstairs next to Mrs. Westaway's room in case she needed me in the night."
"I see," Hal said humbly. She shivered. She had never felt more out of place in her draggled wet coat, her laddered tights, her short black hair drying into spikes from the rain. "She was lucky to have you."
"She was,"
Mrs. Warren said. Her mouth was a thin line of pinched disapproval.
"God knows the family cared little enough for her comfort. Oh, I see you're all happy enough to come down picking like magpies over the spoils now."
I didn't,"
Hal started, nettled, but then stopped as Mrs. Warren turned away and hobbled down a short, unlit corridor towards a closed door, rattling the knob with her gnarled hand. What could she say? It was true after all. At least as far as she herself was concerned. She let her mouth fall shut and waited as Mrs. Warren struggled with the stiff knob, her cane clamped under her arm.
"Damp,"
Mrs. Warren said shortly over her shoulder as she tugged at the knob.
"Frame swells."
"Can I?"
Hal began, but it was too late. As the words left her mouth, the door gave suddenly, and a flood of cold light illuminated the landing. Mrs. Warren stood back and let Hal pass through. Inside was a narrow little room, painfully bare, with a metal bedstead in one corner, a washstand in the other, and a barred nursery window overlooking the garden. There was no carpet, only bare boards, and a tiny knotted rug by the head of the bed. There was also no radiator, just a small grate filled with coal and kindling already laid out. The bars gave Hal a strange feeling in the pit of her stomach, though she could not have said why. Perhaps it was the incongruity of finding them up here in the attic. On the ground floor they might have been needed to keep out intruders, but up here there was only one explanation. These were not bars to keep someone out, but in. Only, this was not a nursery room, where the bars might be needed to safeguard a clambering toddler. It was a maid's room, far from the rest of the house, totally impractical for a small child. What kind of person needed to stop their maids from escaping?
"Well, here you are," Mrs. Warren said irritably. "There's matches on the mantelpiece, but we're short of coal, so don't be thinking you can have a fire willy-nilly now. There's no money to burn. I'll leave you to unpack."
Thank you, Hal said. The little room was achingly cold, and her teeth chattered though she tried to keep her jaw clenched tight to stop it. When should I come down?
"The others aren't here yet,"
Mrs. Warren said, seeming to answer her question without quite doing so.
"No doubt they went round by the coast road. It's always bad this time of year, with the storms."
And she turned, before Hal could ask any more questions, and stumped off down the narrow stairs. Hal waited, and heard the door at the bottom slam smartly shut, and then she sank down on the little bed and took in her surroundings. The room was barely a couple of meters side to side, and the barred window gave it the feeling of a cell, even with the door open. It was also extremely cold. As the air settled around her, Hal realized that she could see her breath if she huffed hard enough. There was a mint-green eiderdown on the bed, and Hal pulled it off the mattress and wrapped it around her shoulders. The fragile satin pulled beneath her fingers so that she was afraid the fabric might disintegrate in her grip, but she was too cold to sit without some kind of warmth. She thought about lighting the fire, but it seemed pointless when she would have to go downstairs to face the family. And just the thought of asking the disapproving Mrs. Warren for another scuttle of coal made Hal quail, remembering her thinned lips and grim expression. Did Mrs. Warren dislike all the family this much, or was it just Hal, she wondered. Perhaps it was because of the short notice of her arrival, though she hadn't seemed exactly surprised. Perhaps it was her draggled dress and shoes. Or could it be, did she suspect something? There had been something Hal couldn't quite pin down in her expression when she saw Hal, a kind of wary calculation. It was the look, Hal suddenly thought, of a child who sees a cat appear among a flock of pigeons and stands back to watch the slaughter. What did it mean? Hal shivered again in spite of the eiderdown, and then, remembering her vow on the journey over, she pulled her phone out of her bag and opened up the search screen. Her fingers, as she typed the words in the search box, were stiff and reluctant, not only with cold, and she paused for a long moment before she hit the search button. Maud Westaway, St. Piran, missing, dead. Then she pressed enter. The little icon whirred for a long time, long enough for Hal to look doubtfully at the coverage bars in the top right-hand corner of the screen. 2 out of 5. Not great, but it should be enough to get some kind of internet, surely. At last, the results flashed up on the screen, and Hal felt her stomach flip. For there, right at the top of the list, was the piece she had known would come up. It was a newspaper link about her mother's death. Maud, crossed out. Westaway, St. Piran, crossed out. Missing dead, said the greyed-out text beneath the link, showing that it didn't tick all the search boxes, but that nonetheless this piece was the best match. Hal didn't click. She didn't need to. The information she needed didn't lie in this piece with its lurid details and sorrowful tone. Self-styled psychic practitioner, Hal remembered, and familiar local figure in her characterful dress, as though her mother were one step away from a medicated stay in a secure facility rather than a cheerful, down-to-earth woman making a living for herself and her child in the best way she could. Great loss to the peer community, though, that was true. Hal still remembered the way they had gathered round her when she returned to her mother's booth. The mute sympathy on their faces. The way she had found that for months and months afterwards, cups of hot tea would be left quietly outside her kiosk on cold days, and the mistakes in the change at the fish and chip stand were somehow always in her favour. Now, she blinked as she scrolled past the links about the crash, her vision blurring as she tried to make out the text in the other pieces. She clicked through to a few, but none of them were related. There was a missing West Highland Terrier in St. Piran, and a slew of totally irrelevant links from baby name websites and the St. Piran Tourist Board. At last, she shut down the screen, drew the eiderdown around her shoulders, and simply sat, looking out of the little barred window across the rain-spattered garden. Whoever Maud Westaway had been, whatever had happened to her, she seemed to have gone without a trace. Chapter 12. It was the sound of tires on the gravel outside the window that made Hal's head jerk up, breaking into her thoughts. The satin eiderdown slithered from her shoulders, and she snatched for it reflexively, shivering in the sudden gust of cold wind, and then let it fall as she went to the window to see who had arrived. She could not see the faces of the people below, only the tops of their heads and their umbrellas as they hurried across to the main doors. But she could see the parked cars. They were the two long black saloons, sleek as sharks, that had made up the funeral cortege. The family had arrived. The real test was about to begin. She felt suddenly sick with nerves, light-headed with tension. This was it. A face-to-face encounter with her supposed relatives. Was she really going to do this? She played people for a living. In her moments of clear-eyed honesty, she knew that. But this was different. This wasn't just telling gullible people what they wanted to hear or already knew. This was a crime.
"Bugger tea!"
Hal heard, floating up the stairwell as she reached the second floor.
"Brandy's what I want, or whiskey if you can't do that, Mrs. Warren."
Hal heard no reply from Mrs. Warren, but there was a remark from one of the other brothers and a gust of laughter, and she heard one of Harding's children complaining at having to put away his phone. This was it. The moment of truth. The words floated into her head unbidden, and she let out a short laugh. Truth? No. Lies. The moment of lies. She had been preparing for this her whole life. If anyone can do this, you can, Hal. She flexed her fingers, feeling like a boxer before the fight. Or no, that wasn't quite right. For this was going to be a test of mental agility, not physical. Like a grandmaster before a chess match, perhaps. She saw herself, as if from above, her hand hovering over a pawn, ready to make the first move. The cold seemed to be leaving her now, and her face felt flushed and hot with anticipation as she descended the next flight of stairs, her heart beating hard beneath the black dress.
"Let's see if we can't get you some hot chocolate, darling,"
she heard from a female voice. Not Mrs. Warren, for it was clipped and rather moneyed. Mitzi, presumably.
"That morbid wait by the grave was the absolute limit, Harding. Kitty's frozen. Where are the bloody radiators in this place?"
"There aren't any, Mitch. You know that perfectly well. But I expect there's a fire in the drawing room."
As she rounded the corner of the stairs, she saw them all. Harding struggling out of a barber jacket, Abel tapping on his phone in the corner of the room, still in his raincoat, Mitzi pulling layers off the children. Not one of them looked up as she began to make her way down the final flight, until she stepped on a loose board and Ezra's head came up.
"Hello,"
he drawled, and Hal felt her face flush as all the heads turned towards her, their expressions ranging from curiosity to frank surprise.
"I saw you at the funeral, didn't I?"
"Yes," Hal said. She swallowed. Her throat felt dry and sore, almost as if a thorn were stuck there digging in.
"Yes, my name's Hal, short for Harriet, Harriet Westaway."
Their faces didn't change until a little dry cough came from behind Harding's shoulder.
"Harriet is Maud's daughter."
It was Mr. Treswick who had spoken, and his quiet voice cut through the chatter in the hallway like a knife through cheese. The name plainly meant nothing to the younger members of the group, nor to Mitzi, who carried on as if he hadn't spoken, shooing her children towards a room up the corridor, complaining audibly as she departed about the smell of damp. But to the three brothers, it was as if he had sworn or smashed the empty china vase standing at the foot of the stairs. Harding felt for the chair behind him and sat down abruptly, as if he no longer trusted his legs. Abel gave an audible gasp, and his hand went to his collar. Only Ezra didn't move. He went quite still, and his face turned pale.
She had a child?"
It was Harding who spoke first, the words clotted and thick as though he had to force them out.
"Why didn't we know?"
"No one knew," Mr. Treswick said, "except, evidently, your late mother. Perhaps your sister told her, I am not certain."
But Abel was shaking his head.
"She had a child,"
he said, repeating his brother's words, but with an entirely different emphasis, as if he could not believe the words or the reality behind them.
"She had a child? But it makes no sense."
Hal felt her stomach shift, and she gripped the banister tightly, feeling her sweaty palms slide against the polished wood.
"It makes no sense,"
Abel repeated.
"She wasn't... She didn't..."
"Nevertheless," Mr. Treswick said, "here is Harriet."
Hal took a step down into the hallway, feeling her heart beating fast and hard inside her chest, thinking of the part she had to play. "It's natural for you to be nervous," she told herself. "You're meeting your family for the first time. You can use this fear. Make it your own."
"I didn't know I had an uncle,"
she said, not trying to hide the tremor in her voice as she held out her hand towards Harding.
Let alone three.
And he took it, his fingers warm and thick around her cold ones, and shook it hard in both of his, as if that handshake could somehow seal a bond between them.
"Well, well, well,"
he was saying.
"Very pleased to meet you, Harriet."
But it was Abel who pulled her into a hug, crushing her glasses into his damp raincoat so hard that she could feel his heart beating beneath her cheek.
"Welcome home,"
was all he said, his voice shaking with a kind of painful sincerity.
"Oh, Harriet, welcome home."
5th of December, 1994. Maud knows. She came to my room last night after I had gone to bed, but I knew before that. I knew from her expression as she watched me over the dinner table, pushing the congealing cod and limp broccoli around my plate with my fork, feeling the nausea rise at the back of my throat. I knew then, from the look she gave me, and the way she shoved her plate away and stood up, that she had guessed.
"Sit down,"
her mother snapped.
"You do not leave this table without asking permission."
Maud gave her a look close to hate, but she sat back down. "May I leave the table?" she said, spitting each word out as if it were one of the stray bones from the cod arrayed around the edge of her plate. Her mother looked at her, and I saw a flicker of something pass over her face, a desire to thwart, mixed with the knowledge that one day she was going to push Maud too far, and that if Maud defied her, there would be nothing she could do in the end.
"You may,"
she said at last, though the last word was dragged out. But then, as Maud stood, she added,
"When you have finished your fish..." "I can't eat it," Maud said. She threw her napkin on the table. "Nor can Maggie. Look at it. It's disgusting. Nothing but bones and tasteless white shit."
I saw the tip of my aunt's nose go white, as it always does when she is furious.
"You will not speak about the food in this house that way," she said. "I won't lie about it either. God knows there are enough lies in this house already. What does that mean?"
Her mother stood now too, and they faced each other so alike and yet so different. Maud is hot where her mother is cold, passionate where her mother is contained. But the bitterness and anger in each face made them look more alike than I ever realized before.
"You know what it means."
With that, Maud picked up the flaccid piece of cod with her fingers and crammed it into her mouth. I thought I heard the bones crunch as she chewed, and I felt the nausea rise up in my throat, making me sweat with the effort of containing it.
"Happy?"
Maud said, though the word was barely comprehensible through the suffocating mouthful. Then, without waiting for an answer, she turned on her heel and left, slamming the dining room door behind her so that the china rattled on the table. I bent my head over my plate and, trying not to let my shaking hands show, I speared a potato onto my fork and put it into my mouth, my eyes blurring. "Don't look at me," I thought desperately, knowing how my aunt's white, cold anger could redirect onto whoever was unlucky enough to catch her attention. "Don't look at me." But she didn't. Instead, I heard the screech of her chair legs on the parquet, and the slam of the door on the other side of the room, and when I looked up, I was blessedly, entirely alone. It was much later that Maud came to my room. I was sitting in bed in my dressing gown, a hot water bottle at my feet, sorting my cards.
I heard feet on the stairs, and at first my stomach clenched, not sure who it was. But then there came a tap on the wooden door, and I knew. Maud?
Yes, it's me.
Her voice was low, and I could tell she didn't want anyone to hear.
Can I come in?
Yes, I whispered back. The handle turned, and she came into the room, ducking her head beneath the low attic doorway. She was wrapped in a huge cardigan, and her feet were bare.
God, aren't you freezing?
I asked, and she nodded, her teeth chattering. Without speaking, I pushed over in the narrow bed, patted the pillow beside me, and she climbed in, her feet like ice as she slid them down past my legs.
I hate her, was all she said. I hate her so much. How can you stand to be here?
I have no other choice, was what I thought. But I knew that I had as many choices as Maud, maybe more.
She acts like it's the 1950s, Maud said bitterly. No TV, you and me shut up here like fucking nuns. Mrs. Warren toiling away in the kitchen. Did she realise people don't live like this anymore? Other people our age are out there going to gigs, getting drunk, screwing each other. Don't you care that we're shut up here in Mother's post-war fantasy land?
I didn't know what to say. I couldn't tell her that I had never wanted to get drunk or go to gigs. That I never had, even when I had the chance.
Maybe I fit in with it better than you, I said at last.
Mum always said I was an old-fashioned thing.
Tell me about your mum, she said quietly,
and I felt a lump rise in my throat, thinking of Mum as she always is in my mind's eye, digging in the garden with Dad alongside her, humming along to Paul Simon, hoeing the onions or planting bulbs. I tried not to think of those last nightmare months, Mum gasping her last on a ventilator, and Dad's heart attack a few weeks later.
What's to tell? I said, trying not to sound as bitter as I felt. She's dead. They're both dead. End of.
The unfairness of it still makes me gasp. But there's a kind of rightness in it, too. That's what I've realised. I was the child of two people completely in love. They were meant to be together, in life and in death. I just wish that that death hadn't come so soon.
I want to understand, Maud said, her voice very low. I want to understand what it must be like not to hate your mother.
This time, it wasn't the chill of her feet, but the venom in her voice that made me shiver. My aunt isn't an easy woman, I know that. I knew that before I even came to live here. The fact that she had managed to fight with my father told me everything I needed to know. He was the most mild-mannered man you can imagine. But nothing had prepared me for the reality of what I found here.
I wish I could get away.
She spoke with quiet venom into her knees.
She let him go.
She didn't say who. She didn't have to say. We both knew who she was talking about. Ezra, away at boarding school. He had escaped.
Is it the boy thing, do you think? I asked.
Maud shrugged, trying to look unconcerned. But I wasn't fooled. Her cheeks were wet where she had cried after supper.
Girls aren't worth educating, she said, with a bitter little laugh. Or not worth paying to educate, anyway. But whatever she thinks, I've got twice his brains. I'll be at Oxford while he's still sitting retakes at some shitty crammer in Surrey.
I'm going to show her this summer. Those exams are my ticket out of here. I didn't say what I was thinking, which was, what about me? If Maud leaves, what will I do? Will I be imprisoned here, alone, with her?
I used to hate this room, Maud said softly.
She used to lock us in here as children for punishment. But now,
I don't know. It feels like an escape from the rest of the house.
There was a long silence.
I tried to imagine it. Tried to imagine having a mother who would do that, and what it would do to you as a child to suffer through that. And my imagination failed.
Can I sleep here tonight? She asked, and I nodded.
She rolled over, and I switched out the light. I turned on my side, my back to her. We lay in the darkness, feeling the warmth of each other at our spines, the shift and creak of the mattress whenever the other moved. I was almost asleep when she spoke. Her voice, a whisper so soft I wasn't sure at first if she was speaking or sighing in her sleep.
Maggie, what are you going to do?
I didn't answer. I just lay there, staring into the blackness, feeling my heart beating hard in my chest at her words.
She knows.
Chapter 13. The next half hour was a blur of questions and evasions, harder than Hal had ever imagined, but strangely exhilarating at the same time. As she stumbled through the conversation, desperately trying to remember what she had said to whom, she found herself abandoning the chess analogy and returning to the image of herself as a boxer, strapping up her knuckles before clambering into the ring to dodge punches, sidestep questions, and turn awkward inquiries back onto the person opposite her. And yet this was no one-to-one sparring match. A single opponent would have been a setup much more within her comfort zone. She was used to that, although this was very far from the controlled environment of her little kiosk. But this confused melee was something entirely different. Jumbled voices cutting across each other, prodding her for answers before she had finished responding to another speaker, butting in with anecdotes and reminiscences. It was so far from what she was accustomed to that she felt almost punch drunk, pummeled by the sound. All her life, family had meant one thing, her and her mother. The two of them, bound together, self-sufficient. Growing up, Hal had never felt that there was anything missing, but she had sometimes yearned for the big family holidays of other children at school, the endless ranks of brothers, sisters, cousins to play with, and piles of presents at Christmas and birthdays that came from a large tribe of relatives. Now, as they crowded around her, talking over each other in jangling voices, asking her about her upbringing, her schooling, her current situation, she found herself wondering how she could ever have envied the other children, their uncles and aunts. Harding was the most difficult. Direct question after direct question barked in that rather sergeant-major voice like an interrogation. Abel's style was very different, lighter, friendlier. Time and again, when Hal ran up against something she couldn't answer, he broke in with a chuckle and an anecdote of his own. Ezra said nothing, but Hal felt his eyes upon her, watching. It was Mitzi who interrupted at last with a laugh that Hal would have found grating under other circumstances.
"Good heavens, boys!"
She pushed into the circle of dark suits, swatting Abel on the shoulder and taking Hal's hand.
"Leave the poor girl alone for a few minutes. Look at her, she's quite overwhelmed. Can I offer you some tea, Hal?"
Yes, Hal said. "Yes, but please."
On the pier, she tried to hide her occasional stammer and she deliberately kept her voice low and slow to seem older than her years and emphasize the fact that she was in control and they, the Querents, were on her territory. Here, she realized, as Mitzi led her away from the group, her discomfort was her alibi, and she could use it to her own ends. She shouldn't try to hide her confusion or her youth. Far from it. As she followed Mitzi across the drawing room, she hunched her shoulders to make her already slight frame seem even smaller, let her fringe fall over her face like a shy teenager. People tended to underestimate Hal. Sometimes that could be an advantage. She let Mitzi usher her across to a sofa by the fire where one of the Westaway grandsons was sitting, jabbing at his phone in a way that made Hal think he must be playing some kind of game. It wasn't Richard. Who was the other one? Freddy?
There you go, Mitzi said comfortingly as Hal sat down. Now, can I get you something? Are you old enough for a glass of wine?
Yes, and have been for several years, Hal thought, but she didn't say that. Drinking here would not be a good idea. Instead, she gave a deliberately uncertain laugh. I'd prefer that tea you mentioned, thank you.
I'll be right back, Mitzi said, and tapped her son sharply on the head. Freddy, turn that off.
Freddy didn't even pretend to put his phone down as his mother left, but he glanced sideways at Hal.
Hi, Hal said. I'm Harriet.
Hi, Harriet. What's your tattoo?
My tattoo?
Hal was momentarily surprised and then realized that the cotton dress had slipped a little, showing one shoulder and the tip of a wing.
Oh, this one?
She pointed to her back and he nodded.
Looks like a bird.
It's a magpie.
Cool.
He spoke without looking up, apparently negotiating a tricky bit of the game. Then he added,
I want to get a tattoo, but Mum says over her dead body.
It's illegal before you're 18, Hal said briefly.
Here at least she was on safe ground.
No reputable tattooist would agree to it, and you don't want to be going to the ones who would. How old are you?
12,
he said sadly. He shut down his phone and looked up at her for the first time.
Can I see it?
She felt an instant sense of intrusion, but she didn't know what else to say.
Yes, I guess.
She turned and felt him pull down the cotton of the neckline, exposing the bird, its head cocked to one side. His fingers were cold against her skin, and she tried not to shiver.
Cool,
he said again, enviously this time.
Did you pick it because of this place? You know, all of them.
He waved a hand at the trees outside the window, and Hal turned. It was too dark to make out much more than the light from the window glittering on wet boughs. But in her mind's eye, she saw again the line of magpies perched on the dripping branches of the yew. She shook her head, pulling the neckline of her dress back up to cover the bird.
No, my mum's...
Too late, she realized she had let her guard down and had been on the verge of making a horrifying mistake. The truth was that she had got the tattoo in memory of her mother, Margarida, one for sorrow. It had seemed apt at the time, but cold horror washed over her at the realization that she had been about to admit her mother's real name.
Stupid, stupid. Her nickname for me was Magpie, she said,
after a pause long enough to feel like a chasm opening beneath her feet. As cover stories went, it was beyond lame, but it was the best she could manage on the hop. Regardless, the boy didn't seem to have noticed the yawning pause.
Is she Dad's sister?
He asked. Hal nodded.
Yes.
Well, I guess I should say was Dad's sister. She's dead, right?
Freddy!
Mitzi came up with a cup of tea, and when she set it down on the table, she lightly slapped her son's knee.
That is not... I'm so sorry, Harriet. He's a teenage boy, what can I say?
It's okay, Hal said, truthfully. It wasn't just the nugget of fact he had held out to her, confirming what she had already guessed. It was the fact that she was suddenly on safe ground here. There was no shock in hearing the words from other people. In fact, she preferred the boy's bluntness rather than the delicate passed away or fell asleep that some people used. Her mother was not asleep or in the next room. She was dead. No amount of euphemism would soften that fact, and this at least was true.
Yes, she's dead, she said to Freddy. I got this tattoo in her memory.
Cool,
the boy said again, semi-automatically. He looked awkward now in the presence of his mother.
Do you have any others?
Yes, Hal said, at the same time as Mitzi broke in.
Freddy, for heaven's sake, stop bothering poor Harriet with personal questions. This isn't appropriate conversation, or...
She stopped, the words, a funeral, unspoken on her lips. Hal smiled, or tried to, and picked up the tea.
Really, it's fine.
Questions about her tattoos were easier to answer than the ones Abel, Harding, and Ezra had been asking. She felt a shift in her stomach as she saw Harding pat one of his brothers on the shoulder and then follow his wife over to the fire.
"Warming up, Harriet,"
he said as he came up to the little knot seated on the sofa.
"Very wise. This place is nothing short of perishing, I'm afraid. Mother didn't really believe in modern comforts like central heating."
Has it been in the family long?" Hal asked. She remembered what her mother had said about conducting readings. Don't let them ask all the questions. Ask some of your own. It's easier to direct the conversation if you're in the driving seat, and they'll feel flattered if you show an interest.
My mother didn't ever talk about this place, she added, honestly.
Oh, donkey's years, I believe, Harding said carelessly.
He settled himself with his back to the fire, fanning up the hem of his jacket to let the heat reach his back.
"The oldest part of the building is this bit where we're sitting now, which was built in the 1700s and was quite a modest farm for many years. Then your great-great-grandfather, my mother's grandfather, made rather a lot of money in the late 1800s from china clay up near St. Austell. And he used it to completely revamp the place in rather grand style. He kept the Georgian core of the old farmhouse as the reception rooms and main bedrooms, but built a sprawl of wings and servants' quarters in the arts and crafts style, turning it into quite an imposing place. However, unfortunately, his son wasn't a very good businessman, and he lost control of the mine to his business partner. Since then, there's been very little money for upkeep, so the house is somewhat frozen in the 1920s. It needs a good £1 million investment to bring it up to spec. Certainly not money your average buyer has hanging around, though it's the sort of thing one of the big hotel chains might accomplish. Of course, the land is what's really worth the money now.
He looked out of the window across the rain-swept expanse of grass, and Hal could almost see him calculating, imagining Barrett Holmes sprouting up like mushrooms, hearing the ka-ching of cash registers as each new seed germinated into a sale. Hal nodded and sipped her tea for want of something to say. Her hands were still cold in spite of the heat of the fire, but her cheeks felt hot, and all of a sudden she sneezed and then shivered convulsively.
"Bless you,"
Abel said. Harding had taken a step backwards, almost tripping over the fender.
"Oh, dear, I hope you haven't caught a cold at the graveside."
"I doubt it," Hal said. "I'm very tough."
But she ruined the words by sneezing again. Abel pulled out a beautifully laundered cotton handkerchief and held it out solicitously, but Hal shook her head.
"Biscuit, Hal?"
Mitzi said, and Hal took one, remembering that she had not eaten since that morning. But when she put the shortbread in her mouth, it tasted dry and stale, and she was not sorry when there was a cough from the other end of the room, and Mr. Trezick raised his voice above the conversation.
"If I might have a moment of your attention, everyone?"
Harding shot a look at Abel, who shrugged, and the two men made their way down the long room towards the lawyer, who was standing beside a grand piano shuffling papers. Hal half rose from the sofa, but then stood uncertainly, unsure whether the summons included her, until Mr. Trezick said,
"You too, Harriet."
He put down his file of papers and walked to the door, opening it to the corridor so that Hal felt the draught of cold air from outside, a sharp contrast to the fire-warmed room.
"Mrs. Warren,"
he called, his voice echoing along the passageway,
"do you have a moment?"
"Are the children needed?" Mitzi said, and Mr. Trezick shook his head.
"No, not unless they would like to listen. But if Ezra could join us... Where is he, by the way?"